Ron Tite was named one of the top 10 creative Canadians by Marketing Magazine. A best-selling author, speaker, producer, and entrepreneur, Ron has always blurred the lines between art and commerce. He's been an award-winning advertising writer and creative director for some of the world's most respected brands, including Air France, Evian, Fidelity, Hershey, Johnson & Johnson, Kraft, Intel, Microsoft, Volvo, and many more. He is the founder of Church & State, an in-demand speaker around the world. Ron speaks to leading organizations about leadership, disruption, branding, and creativity. And Ron, I promise you, I will not end this intro with the intro that you were given on the former sports show in Canada, Off the Record, when they called you Canada's funniest man. Ron, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, Jamie. Where'd you dig that up, Bo? What is this, Brian Linehan? You're doing your research?
Yes. Well, what a compliment, Brian Linehan. Well, why is that not a good intro?
Well, it's not a good intro because in any world, in the comedy world, you never really want to really elevate somebody too much because it sets up a level of expectation. I remember Jerry Seinfeld talking about this, where Tom Papa said he's the greatest comedian ever. Please welcome Jerry Seinfeld. And when you say that, the audience is like, oh, really? We'll be the judge of that. So it just makes it seem, it makes you seem arrogant that you would have that somewhere in a bio. And so you never want to set an expectation of that. You want to deliver that as the best thing they've ever heard, but you never want to preface what you do with, this is going to be the greatest thing you've ever heard.
Yeah. Well, thank you for making the time to be here. I'd love to jump in and look back before we move to where you are today, because your journey is fascinating. Let's go to overnight camp when you were about 17 years old.
Yeah.
How did that experience shape where you are today?
Oh, and in like 25 different ways. You know, I went there because I saw the movie Meatballs. Really, that's really what it comes down to. And I said, how do I do that? Like, I want to experience that. That's cool. And we, you know, my mom couldn't afford to send me to a sleepaway camp. So when I got old enough that I could work at a camp, I kind of did the research on it and found out that you can get a job there as a counselor at 17. I applied to Ontario Camping Association and went. And I knew nothing of that world, like absolutely nothing. I was the guy that showed up with two suitcases. Like, that's how out of it I was. And so, I mean, one, just that step of, this sounds a little bit lame, but having the bravery or the courage to go like, I'm going to go explore something that I have no idea what I'm about to get into. And kind of doing that at 17 and having it really be completely enjoyable and life-changing sets you up so that you're not as, I wasn't as afraid of taking other big, bold steps in the future. Because like, hey, this worked out in the past. So it helped from that. It helped from just a creativity standpoint, because when you're at camp, you don't have the big budgets that we have in corporate. So you kind of do things on the fly. It was a really incredibly creative environment to be in. The collaboration of all these people. But also culturally, you know, I grew up kind of poor in the south end of Oshawa, and, you know, there weren't a lot of kids named Cohen who were in my neighborhood. And so my connection to the Jewish community was non-existent. And I landed at this camp, and, you know, it was probably 95% kids and staff who were Jewish. And so that cultural kind of perspective on stuff, and as you know, Jamie, the Italians and the Jews, my mother's maiden name is Bocino. The Italians and the Jews are just kind of a really, I think, really similar culturally in so many different ways. And so it kind of just introduced me to a whole group of people, not just culturally, but socioeconomically, like everything. I just absolutely loved it and cherished my times there, as well as the relationships that I built there.
And a few years later, when you were at University of Queens, you accepted a job in the business school. How did that particular experience shape what you do now and your perspective on business?
Well, it was a job. I went in there as a student, as a phys ed. I did a phys ed degree, like most people. And I was doing lifestyle programs in there. And then they offered me a full-time job. And I was like, what are you talking about? I'm a phys ed grad. Like, why are you offering me a job in the business school? And the director at the time was a guy named Gordon Cassidy, who said, look, here's what I love about phys ed grads, what I love about you for this job, which was being kind of leading, working to launch the National Executive MBA program. He's like, you went to Queens, so you're clearly smart. You got in here. As a phys ed grad, you understand the importance of individual contribution to a team. You understand that, the role, because of athletics, that individuals have in contributing to a team. You're social. You're really good to kind of just get along with people, and you're competitive, and all the technical stuff that the BCOMs use, like I'll teach you that. That's not a big deal. The more important stuff that is more difficult to develop and more difficult to recruit is that other stuff. Is can you be social? Can you collaborate? Can you be a good team member? Can you learn? And are you driven? And all that stuff kind of, I think, justified that most of us can, within reason, can kind of do whatever we want, because those are the skills that really drive us into business. Now, how did it shape my thinking on business? Well, you take somebody who has no background in business and you throw them into an entrepreneurial program, which is really helping develop this thing that had never been done by anybody in North America before. So it was a startup. So I gathered all those skills. It was within an academic environment. So I gathered all those skills. And from a business perspective, I sat into every single class that these executive MBA students were taking. So I was surrounded by the best business thinkers in the country, both the participants who were executives and the professors. So I basically did an MBA. And had real world experience applying those lessons directly into the program. It was the best first job anybody could ever have.
And one thing you mentioned there, it was surrounding yourself for the first time with leading business thinkers across Canada, whether the professors, practitioners, possibly other students. When you went into business yourself, which we'll get to shortly in more detail, what qualities or attributes do you look for in partners and employees? Obviously, those are possibly different. What do you look for?
I look for people I want to work with. Like, I look for people I want to hang out with. I look for people that, I think it's really important, especially now, the speed of, this is nothing new, but the speed of change is so fast and the pace of transformation is constant. We all know that. But because of that, what I think we come into contact with fewer people who have the answers, because all those answers they claim to have were based on a case study from 5 years ago. Like, they're based on something they did 12 months ago. It's already changed. And so I think we have to look less for people with the exact answers or experience we're looking for, and instead we should look to people who have enough experience, who have an interesting perspective on stuff, but who really we want to collaborate with to find the right answer, and that they have enough experience and perspective to kind of know where to go and have some opinions on it. But we need to be comfortable with people who we're in the trenches with, who we're just kind of going, let's figure this out together, and let's try some stuff, and let's embrace our successes. And it's really important. Let's just kind of share our values and apply those values to the project or initiative or campaign or whatever we're working on.
Yeah, on your point about working with people you want to hang out with, Michael Blake, the executive director of Dances with Wolves and was the screenwriter, he was asked that and he said something similar to what you said. He said, I choose collaborators the same way I choose friends, with the same values. And he listed a series of traits like energize, people who are energetic, who are positive, who push me intellectually, who are good at give and take. Like, he listed a series of things, and he said that's been his primary way of judging who he wants to surround himself with. So interesting.
Yeah, I think that's paramount, because it always gets stressful. It always can get heated in discussions, and especially when, you know, there's a debate as to how you move forward on stuff. And so knowing that, wouldn't you rather just be with somebody that you'd want to be with? You know, like, I don't know. I think that's really important, and it doesn't get nearly enough attention.
So after Queens Business School, when you had that, maybe it's overstating, but that transformational experience grounding you in where you might go in the future, planting a seed. When you were a creative director and writing ads, how did you shift from being an employee to running your own agency, to founding Church and State?
Well, logistically, I quit and incorporated a business. If only, you know, it was really that simple, but that's kind of what you do, right? You decide, like, there were a bunch of forces at play there. There was, I never had this entrepreneurial drive of like, I can't wait to start my own thing. That was never in the cards. I just never thought I would do that. You end up at a point, you know, in your career where you get to a point and you start to get frustrated with the environment you're in. I was really frustrated. And when it started to affect, because it was, you know, this was the rise of social media, and that was changing how we advertised and connected with consumers. And so there was that. It was like the business itself was changing. It was also at a time where the agency that I was a part of had two, you know, founding partners who had sold the business. And they were kind of maybe one foot out the door, not really, you know. And so I thought, well, that dynamic has changed. And then I also had this speaking kind of side of things that was really starting to take off, and I was starting to get distracted. So it was less about I want to start my own business, and it was more about I want to control my destiny. And then I didn't want to check in with people, and I didn't want to get approval from New York, and I also didn't want to, you know, hose people. I didn't want to be, you know, cheating somebody that I was employed by. So I just thought it's so much easier if I just control my own destiny. And so I'm going to focus on speaking. I'm going to focus on solving the problems that I want to solve. And maybe I'll start a thing, but I didn't even know what the thing was. I really knew what problem I wanted to solve, but I didn't know whether that was going to be as a production company, as a consultant, as an agency, like what it was going to be. I just knew that I wanted to solve it. And I knew that the speaking could drive great biz dev, and that speak, I mean, you can't, you know, that you can't scale speaking. I mean, you can charge more money, and you can add on more SKUs and products and stuff like that, but it's you. Like, that's the business. You can't sell it. There's no exit from a speaking career because it's all based on you. So when you look at all that together, I was like, I'm going to pursue the speaking, and I'm going to kind of have a corporate entity that can apply some of that thinking in some kind of way. Let's just figure that out. And so the first name was The Tight Group. And why? Because I wasn't exactly sure what it was going to be. And I wanted the flexibility to make it whatever the heck I needed to make it in order to best solve the problem.
What's the story or the metaphor behind the name Church and State?
Well, it's not. We get like one email a week that's like, would you like a list of all the churches in the Southern United States? And we're like, we're not a spiritual organization. So in advertising circles, marketing circles, the separation of church and state, we know how that kind of lives politically, the separation of church and state, literally the separation of church and religion and government, the state. But in advertising, the separation of church and state was always about the separation of advertising and content or editorial. And so you could never go to the Globe and Mail and say, hey, we'll run an ad in your publication if you write an article about us. The Globe and Mail would say that is the separation of church and state. And I felt that increasingly that was becoming the unification of church and state. As we took the cost of production way down and we took global gave people global and instantaneous distribution, and the ability to generate content for niche audiences. Well, now the line of advertising and editorial was really, really fuzzy. And so it was no longer the separation of church and state. It was the unification of church and state, that those two things could come together in a really responsible way that served the needs of consumers or clients and was still credible. It's not that we were just completely selling everything away or selling out. It's that any ad can be an amazing piece of content. It really can. If it's good enough, it could be an amazing piece. We all share ads all the time. And so we can create ads thinking that they're also content. And pure play content can also be an ad. When the Globe and Mail at the bottom of an article says, for more information, go to globeandmail.ca, whatever their URL is, they're sending you to a place that has additional advertising vehicles attached to it. So it's an ad as much as it is content and helpful content. And so we can have those worlds combine, and nobody was looking at it. Nobody was looking at the interplay between this world of advertising and the ecosystem of advertising and its decreasing effectiveness and the world of content and editorial and its decreasing effectiveness. And they always treated them as two separate worlds, but they each subsidize one another. Ads pay for content, and content typically is the thing that people show up for. They don't show up for ads. They show up for content. And it's a beautiful system. It just had changed.
One of the things I'm hearing here, and you would never call yourself Michael Port, one of the leading speaking coaches and trainers and speakers himself in the world, he called you a visionary. It was actually in the introduction of your book, Think Do Say. You described seeing something that in some ways was a gap where people weren't seeing at the time. And your company, people can check this out, has grown significantly over the past few years. What do you attribute that growth to?
Well, thank you. That's a lovely compliment. And Michael Port is incredible. He's an amazing human being and amazing thinker and leader in the kind of presentation speaking space. And he's a good friend. I think it's a bunch of things. One is that we've never really tried to become too big. I think we're 25 people or something now. Or I guess we're 75 people if we combine with our partner Substance out of Montreal, who we own a piece of and they own a piece of us. But we've just kind of wanted to focus on doing the work and applying the work in that really interesting way. We've been able to grow, I think, because, one, the team is incredible. And it was kind of that first, you know, we used to be called the Tight Group, and our friend Neil Pasricha was the one who said, you're doing a disservice here, that both as a speaker and as a business, that you should be actually be, it should be something more than the Tight Group. There's more people. There's not just Tight. And so the brief to the team on changing the name was less tight, more group. So this needs to be an entity, not just, you know, a Ron thing. And that was the first part of like, oh, yeah, like it's its own thing. But I think overall we have what's really, really helped is we have a very specific operating system or approach that we use, Think, Do, Say. And the book and the speech that I kind of came up with, those are the corporate theater versions. So the kind of really superficial, entertaining, intriguing formats of Think, Do, Say. But on a granular level, when it's applied to a business in the way that we do it, it gets really, really strategic. And it just means that we spend less time figuring out how do we approach a problem and more time on the creative solutions to that problem or the design of the solution to that problem, because we use the same approach every single time. That, I think, has really, really helped us deliver efficiency and profitability and great work. But the team is incredible.
Your team is incredible. On the note of the book, Think, Do, Say, what I'd love to do is give you a few quotes from the book and ask you for a quick impression or to finish the thought.
Okay, sure.
Your clients don't know where to look and they don't know who to trust.
Yeah, that, you know, they don't know where to look because there are more options than ever before. They're looking at, you know, and I use the metaphor of Times Square. They're standing in the middle of Times Square, and which has been designed for consumer eyeballs, and the reality is they're just all coming at them from all different angles. And they don't know where to look because there's a billboard over there and there's a message over there and it's this, you know, constant pitch slapping. Everyone's got a pitch. Everyone's got a promo. Everyone's promising the world. Everyone is using data. It's nonstop and they don't know where to look. They don't know who the priority is. At the same time, if you think of that Times Square metaphor down below of Times Square, well, those aren't the big brands aren't down there. Those are the insurgent forces, right? Those are people. They're not the establishment. They don't have the scripted, polished kind of billboards up top. But those people are more nimble, and those people are more. They can be more targeted. And so that's where kind of disruptive insurgent forces are. So people who are disrupting categories. That's why the explosion of explainer videos happened. Was because there were so many companies coming in going, we're going to do this in a different way. Here's how it works, right? All those videos, they all start with the same line. Here's how it works. And they say that because they're completely changing the way they deliver a specific product or a specific service. But because of that, just like the bottom level of Times Square, some of them are amazing. But there's also some of them, you know, some guys selling ripped off T-shirts over there. And this is a fake Rolex over there. And they don't know whether that new disruptive force is going to be around tomorrow. So you may not like the big established players who've been in business for 40 years, but they've been in business for 40 years. They'll be in business for 41. Those other ones, you're not exactly sure. So they don't know where to look and they don't know who to trust.
You said something earlier, which I just want to draw attention to because I love the phrase. You said a pitch slap. You've been saying that for years.
Yes.
Yeah. I love it.
Jamie, you got to do it with the sound effect. It's pitch slap.
Pitch slap. Yes. I remember seeing you on stage running across pitch slap, pitch slap, pitch slap.
Yeah. Michael Porn helped me with that.
Yeah. I remember that video. It was awesome. the second quote is growth doesn't just isn't about dollars and market share. And momentum isn't just about year over year, month over month, or day over day increases.
Yeah, I mean, growth, everyone thinks growth is financial growth, of course. No, financial growth doesn't happen without personal growth. It just doesn't. Organizations don't drive financial growth unless individual people put their hand up and commit to personal growth and think, well, you know what? I'm gonna look at things differently. I'm gonna do things differently. I'm gonna consciously do things differently and try new things. So I'm going to grow as a person, especially C-suite people. Those are the people who are most in danger of not growing because they all have this belief of like, you know, as Ken Wong said, you know, you got to dance with the one that brung you. You've had a career, 25 years of success. You're going to change the thing that, you know, the approach that got you to that level. Yeah, you need to. So organizational growth is really about personal growth. When individuals grow, then teams grow. And when teams grow, organizations grow. And when organizations grow, the communities that they're a part of grow. And so that it's, I don't know what they want to call it, the growth hierarchy. I think we just created a term, Jamie. It's the growth hierarchy, the Cohen-Tite growth hierarchy.
People, I love it.
Team, organization to community. And then the same thing with momentum. I mean, like, you know, momentum as individuals, we know we've had, in our careers, we've had time and we've had better momentum on our side where we feel like we can't do anything wrong. And then other times when that momentum kind of slows down and we feel like we hit writer's block or we don't know what to do next or we're in a weird impasse. And I think momentum, personal momentum, we need to consciously ensure that that momentum continues, that we're always... You know, part of the, I post a ton on LinkedIn, like 3 times a day. And the reason I do that, just between us, okay, Jamie, don't share this out.
Go ahead. Yeah. I'm with us. Yeah,
I
go
don't
ahead.
give a flying F about LinkedIn.
Yes.
At all. I don't care about it. But I know that I need to keep reading. I know that I need to keep stretching my thinking. I know that I need to kind of keep testing. And there's no open mic night in business or in speaking. And so LinkedIn's my open mic night. So I know I'm gonna post 3 times a day, and I do most of it on the weekend, so it's calendared out and stuff. But so what are those thoughts? So I need to come up with 15 new thoughts a week. Well, the best way to do that is to read articles and be inspired. So it forces me to mentally work out, because there's nothing like this empty calendar of like, I haven't read anything. So it forces me to read, and it forces me to think about what I'm reading, and it forces me to have a perspective on what I've just read, because I'm going to share that perspective out to an audience who is going to, you know, respond with, this is the stupidest thing I've ever heard, or not an insurance, we don't do that, or you got it wrong, or like whatever their feedback is. So LinkedIn for me is just open mic night. I'm thinking this, I read this, I was inspired by this, what about this? And then I take that feedback, and then I go, oh, this, now I know what this is all about. And I take that and I design the slide in the moment, and boom, it goes into a bucket, and I use it in a speech, and then boom, it goes into Scrivener and becomes part of a chapter of the next book. So that for me, I push myself to keep the momentum going consciously, so that I never stop thinking.
Thank you for that. A few things come to mind as Ethan Hawke has spoken of this several times in a short TED Talk. And also recently I saw an interview where he reiterated, he said that success and failure are often not in our control, but what is in our control in terms of creating content or being creative is the process, to be process oriented and to constantly create and putting our passion in, our fully investing our passion into the creation of whatever that may be. And so that's liberating for me to hear that from you as well, because I deeply respect your work, not just as a friend, but I've always admired your, not just the quality, but the frequency and the consistency of what you do. And I remember someone asking you, I don't remember, in our friend circles, what is your creation schedule look like? Because if you listen to the bio of Ron, which I left out quite a bit to keep it framed within what we're talking about, you're the founder and a hands-on leader of, like you said, a team of 25 that just merged in partnership with another company. So you've got that responsibility running this ad firm who deals with Walmart and DoorDash and so many others. You're also one of, if not the busiest speaker I know, keynote speaker for businesses across Canada and North America, not just Canada. We're in the same speaking agency. And also, you're a father, a husband with 2 young kids. So how in the heck do you post 3 times a day? I want to know, it could be briefly, what does your morning routine look like? And how do you schedule your time in order to work that in?
So the first thing is, and it's a question I often get, which is like, are there other people involved, right? Is there somebody else writing? I'm like, no, there's not one person who writes another stitch of what I do in social, to my personal accounts. Other people write stuff for church and state, but personally, no one touches it. We do need, in order to do all the things we want to do, we need to learn how to do them efficiently. So I think that's the first thing, which is, what's the most efficient way that I can do this? Because the sweet spot isn't about the surfing around and finding the articles and all that. It's like reading them. It's actually reading them. So how do I find them and get to them and share them in the most efficient way possible? So I don't do it on a daily basis. So there's two things that I do. So there's two things that are really important. One is Buffer and one is Feedly. So Feedly is an RSS reader, and I just follow and track articles and publications and bloggers and just, you know, content sources that I just follow on a regular. So they're all there. So I get to see them all. I get to see all the headlines of all the articles that I've self-selected from a magazine perspective, what I think are important. So if I look at all the articles within the McKinsey report, well, they're not all in my sweet spot. Personal finance, I don't really like that. Operations, I'm not really that guy. So maybe there's only one or two of the 10 that I think are important. So I'll get to read it. So I do all the consuming part on the weekend. It's when the kids are sleeping. It's when they're in playtime. It's when I'm not supposed to be in daddy time. But, you know, it's they're doing their own thing. And this is when I do my thing or after they've gone to bed. So I read it. I share it in the moment. I read it and share it. I only really need to do 15 per week. I can read 15 articles on a Sunday, and I can kind of comment on what that is. And so then I just continually put stuff into Buffer, and Buffer is scheduled out so that it comes out 3 times a day. But it's not like I'm physically posting 3 times a day. And so in my daily schedule, I will catch up on stuff in the morning right before I start, typically between 8:30 and 9. I'm up at 7:15 getting breakfast for the kids. They're typically out the door by 8:30. I then sit down. I look at random stuff of like, is there a TikTok thing? Is there a YouTube thing? Stuff that's not focused on, you know, my business content. Like the Ethan Hawke that I saw that interview, which was an amazing interview. That if you can't see yourself being a teacher of acting when you're 60 years old, then get the hell out. You know, like, because you just want something else other than the love of acting. Anyhow, so I do that. And as I randomly throughout the week come across stuff that I think is important, I'll just put it into the buffer. So I'm always kind of putting stuff into the pipe. That's how I do it.
So just to review, what were those two different apps that you use? You use Buffer and...
So I use Feedly is where all the content lives that I consume. It's got, you know, so it's I follow Harvard Business Review and all the articles, they're there. All the headlines are there. So that's what I use, Feedly. And then Buffer is the thing that when I share them out, I go, share this to Buffer. Just throw it over to Buffer. And then Buffer, in the back end of Buffer, I've said to Buffer, hey, whatever's in the queue, send it out to LinkedIn at 8:30, 12:30, and 3:30, or whatever the times are. And I'm just going to continue to throw stuff at you, but you only release it 3 times a day.
Yeah, and it's clearly working, not just for the quantity, but because of that visionary ability for you and to combine your ideas that are constantly evolving. You have over 40,000 LinkedIn subscribers, which is not a be all and end all, according to Ethan Hawke. But yet it's working. And so I think the reason I asked that, I'm curious about, because just like other speakers, thinkers on this call, entrepreneurs, business leaders, we're all in the content creation business, so to speak. We're all working to get our message out. And LinkedIn, from what I've observed and studied the past few years, is still the paramount way to do that in the business leadership world.
In some ways. You know who doesn't post to LinkedIn?
Who?
Warren Buffett. You know, like, there are some people who, yes, it can be great, and it works for me. It doesn't have to work for everybody. Mm-hmm. Like, there are ridiculously successful people who just do not build their, they spend zero time on social, they spend zero time on LinkedIn. So what's up with that? Like, oh, well, I think we all have strengths as leaders. And, you know, I saw somebody who said brands want to, customers and consumers want to follow people. And it's your CEO of your organization who should be out creating the content and being the face of the organization. And I said, no. That's just dead wrong. Huge enterprise, publicly traded organizations, you don't necessarily want your CEO out there posting on social. Now, sometimes, sure, that can work. And we just did a big social strategy for the president of a massive institution who wanted to be the face of it. And great, that's going to work for you. And there's a wave, but it doesn't have to be that. And you shouldn't feel the pressure to create content just because it works for some people. It doesn't have to work for all.
Mm-hmm. Another area that you're often described.
Sorry, Jamie, can I just finish up? There's something on that last question. Just one other thing. That I think in the space, a lot of thinkers are people who take their thinking, and their only application is their own career. They go, you can do what I do, especially in the like lead generation and all that new kind of new approach to kind of using social to drive business, where they go, here's what I do. And I've, and my clients who I, you know, they've got leads from Facebook and they convert and like all that kind of stuff. So we're taking this approach that works for individuals and building individuals, excuse me, with a corporate entity. And we're claiming that it's going to work for large enterprise organizations. It's just not true. It's just not all. You can't follow the exact same rules of an individual and apply it to a $1 billion company. Now, some of the things can work, but we're taking advice from a lot of people who only, the only business they have is their own, and they've done great at it, and it's amazing, and they're successful. That's awesome. But we shouldn't say, do what I did in your $1 billion enterprise.
I'm going to hold you to that and ask for the playing the devil's advocate on some level.
Sure.
You interviewed Jack Walsh, the former head of GE, a few years ago in your role as a as an MC, as a speaker, and there was something that surprised you in his response to a question that you had, along the lines of sometimes the people who we don't necessarily have an interest in taking advice from or learning from directly because their experience is so different. What did you take away or learn from that interaction with Jack Walsh when you interviewed him?
Well, one, I wanted to hate him. I really did. I like this Neutron Jack, the guy who fired bottom 10%. I didn't have a lot of respect for him going in. He has since passed away. May he rest in peace. But he was CEO, voted CEO of the century. I mean, this guy really knows his stuff. And he was very, very good. He was brilliant during that time. Now, this is the time of shareholder primacy. This was the era of modern business of shareholder primacy, where everything was done to manipulate shareholder value and drive shareholder value. Now, what we found since then, just before I answer your question, is that all those people like Jack Welch, who we put on pedestals for driving shareholder value, over the long haul, didn't. They just didn't. The GE was removed from the Dow Jones in 2017. So all these people who were focused on manipulating shareholder value, and I don't mean manipulating in an evil way. It was really just about driving and focused on shareholder value. And instead, where we are now is the purpose era, where if we focus on purpose, something that we fundamentally believe in that goes, you know, why we do to the Simon Sinek fans, or something we believe in, but that is strategically linked to where we make our money. It's not cause, but where we make our money. If we focus on that purpose and expand that and focus on delivering that, then we'll drive shareholder value. So I think we have completely done an about face on from where the Jack Welch's of the world were. That doesn't make him evil, just makes him a product of his time, as we all are. But in that moment, my first question to him was, your name is Neutron Jack. That can't make you feel good. Like, that's a horrible legacy. And he said, well, yeah, I did it by fired the bottom 10%. But no one that I ever fired was surprised that they were fired. That all those people knew exactly where they stood because I communicated with absolute radical candor. And all those people, had an idea of where they stood in the organization. What's really immoral is the managers who say, I'm not great at having difficult conversations. Really? And then your boss comes to you and says, you got to lose 2 headcount because of whatever reason. And you got to go to Tom and Mary and you got to let them go. And they don't know that they're the ones that would be let go. They got mortgage. They got children. That's immoral. But as a leader and as a manager, if you can't have the difficult conversations so people know exactly where they stand in your organization, that's immoral. And I walked away with a really profound appreciation for that perspective.
How do you deal with unresolved and unnecessary conflict when you have to have difficult conversations with people in your business world?
Well, there's a couple of, yeah, there's a couple of ways. You know, I mean, our good friend Leanne Davey, who's an exceptional human being and an awesome thinker, kind of introduced something. We brought in Leanne to help us as a management team. When issues were arising, and Leanne, this is Leanne's thing, she introduced the idea of conflict debt to us, where you know, you experience a little bit of conflict and you're like, well, I'm not going to say anything. And then you get deeper into debt. And then eventually you're bankrupt and you explode. And that's a horrible way to deal with conflict, is what, you know, when you've got to the point where you're exploding, because then you start to say stuff that you didn't mean. So how you deal with conflict debt is you don't let yourself get into debt. At the second conflict arises, you deal with it. So my business partner, Robin Whalen, who's a wonderful human being, we get along really, really well, but we're partners. We're going to have conflict. Like, we're completely different people. We disagree on a lot of stuff. And if ever we get into a point where we're like, I don't like this, it's our promise to one another that we raise it. Or if we sense in the other person, you know, like, we just raise it. And then we have and it's typically like, can I grab you for a couple of minutes? And then we know, oh, this is one of those conversations. And then we completely share what's on our brain, why we reacted to something in a certain way and how it made it feel, or why we disagree with it, or whatever. And then we always, always, always end with, love you, Whalen. Love you tight. It's just our sign up to remind ourselves that the love and appreciation we have for one another as business partners occurs in those conversations, that is what makes those conversations, those really difficult conversations, possible, is because we do love and respect one another. That I think seems like it's a weird contradiction of really respecting somebody, but having the wherewithal to have those, having really difficult conversations all the time. And then you develop a shorthand with it. We just know what they're going to think. And we act, it's really funny. Like, we'll say, well, I know what you're going to think about this. You know, you're going to think that we should do this, but let me just hear me out. Just know that this is what I think we should do. And so we're kind of dealing with it proactively.
And I like how you end. That to me is not just, you know, a sweet and respectful way to end. Love you, you know, Robin, love you, Ron. What is last lasts.
Yeah.
You know,
that's a great way to put it.
Yeah. It's elevating people. It's leaving them in a better place than you found the conversation.
Yeah. Cause let's face it, Jamie. I mean, it's not easy being a business partner with a speaker, right? Like, somebody who is like, she'll remind me this, like, you're paid to get on stage to prove to people that you're right. And then going into a business where you actually collaborate with people and you may not be right. Well, that is not an easy dynamic to be a partner in.
Yeah. Probably also as a parent, my daughter who's 10, when I start to give some gentle advice or feedback, she says, oh, Dad, not another TED Talk.
Yeah,
come on,
yeah.
10 years old, she already knows that term. She goes, can you just tell me? I don't need a whole speech. And my son nods like, here we go again.
You're like, but I said I might have slides. I got a slide deck and I got my
slides waiting. Come on, guys.
Yeah.
One of the ongoing themes in your work, both past and present, you're even described like this as a purpose-driven leader. What does purpose-driven leadership mean?
Well, it doesn't mean what people think it means. My I'm working on my next book, will maybe be out in the end of the year, and it's tentatively titled The Purpose of Purpose. Because the purpose of purpose is, and the subtitle is, spoiler alert, it's growth. The purpose of purpose is not social cause. And so when people hear it, they think like, oh, this is someone who, you know, lives with dream catchers and lives in the clouds and saves kittens. I hate cats. All cats should die. No, I'm kidding. I wouldn't say that. But that's not what a purpose-driven leader is. Purpose-driven leader, I think, is somebody who understands that, yes, that the method of how we do things now takes on a social construct and a progressive construct, or it should. So when organizations say, we believe in gender equality, my response is, well, I freaking hope so. Like, I hope so. That's low-hanging fruit. Like, come on. We're here to save the planet. I hope so. That's not purpose at all. Purpose is believing in something more than what you sell, but what you believe strategically linked to what you sell. And that allows, when you take purpose and use purpose in that way, well, now purpose can not only be this, give you the soul behind everything you do, but it gives you the strategic backbone behind everything that you do. That, you know, I've used this phrase that purpose is your pivot foot. Well, in basketball, for those of you watching, I'm now gonna, this is me being in basketball. Okay, so you dribble down the court, and clearly I'm 6'9". I know what I'm talking about here. So you dribble down the and then you stop. And what do? You have a pivot foot. And maybe you take a step in this direction, or you go this direction, or you go in this direction. But the pivot foot is the foot that's anchored to the floor. Your pivot foot is the one that ensures you don't run willy-nilly all over the court and get busted for traveling. Your purpose, your pivot foot keeps you focused and anchored. Now, you can still explore different directions on which way to go and what your next step is going to be or where the ball is going to go next. But you don't just run. There's way too many leaders who they go, oh, we throw a bunch of stuff at the wall and see what sticks. Really? I don't want to work for you because that sounds like chaos. So being purpose-focused is knowing that you come up with something that is a fundamental belief behind what you do, and then you use that to focus your activities against it and to bring it to life. That, to me, is being focused, being purpose-focused.
What happens if someone, if a business owner says, look, I'm a plumber. I have a product. I sell food. Purpose has no place with this. It's really just about profit. My purpose might be somewhere else, but it's not in my business. And by the way, this is something I've heard from time to time, and I find it a challenge to address it head on without feeling judgmental for their right to feel that way.
So, one, I think we need to remind them that purpose is not social cause, right? So when they go, I'm a plumber, what does that have to do with, you know, ensuring that the farmers of Sri Lanka are taken care of or whatever, you know, like, and you go, no, that's not purpose. That's social cause. Now, so here's a perfect example, okay? Last week, Lego came out with a new initiative. Now, what is Lego's purpose? This is a quiz, Jamie. What's the purpose of Lego? What is their fundamental purpose?
Their fundamental purpose is to, I mean, I'm just going by why my kids liked Lego.
Sure.
To provide, to spark joy through creating, building, and yeah, I would say so. It's creating joy through creating and exploring with their hands in a digital world.
There you go. So I think the purpose, as I've loosely kind of interpreted mission, vision, because they don't use brand belief like we do, but what does Lego fundamentally believe? They believe that play and creativity help build the leaders of tomorrow. That's it. Now, is that strategically linked to where they make their money? Yeah. We believe that creativity and play helps builds the leaders of tomorrow. So what do? We have created a toy that they can play and be creative and build with. It exercises those creativity muscles, right? So that's their purpose. And that is their essential do. That's what they do to reinforce their purpose from a product standpoint. Now, what they found, so that's the plumber. If you believe that 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 clean water is a right. We believe that clean water is a right. Amazing. So what do? We ensure that people's homes have clean water at the best times or the most important, like whatever, right? But what LEGO did last week was LEGO got some research where they found that young girls were not getting to the levels and experiencing the levels of creativity that young boys were because they had an expectation of perfection. That young girls have this kind of need to be perfect in their creativity and in their play that young boys don't. And why is that? Well, it's because the language that we as adults and that parents use with young girls that is different from the language we use with young boys. So LEGO created an entire philanthropic stream of content and activities that gave parents training on how to not do this, that reminded young girls that they don't have to be perfect. So a philanthropic activity that is social cause, that is an extension of their brand belief of we believe that play and creativity help build the leaders of tomorrow. And so it's tied to product, it's tied to philanthropic activities. You know that inside the organization, I'm sure that purpose is at play there with employees. If they want to develop the leaders of tomorrow in their own organization, that there's an element of creativity that is really important. So that's how I would deal with the plumber. Yeah, no, you shouldn't save the world, but you believe in something more than just plumbing. Because if you don't, then what y'all got is a commodity. And we know how commodities work. Lowest price wins. And you're an individual plumber, you're not going to win that battle. So what do you fundamentally believe?
How do you describe your purpose at Church and State?
We believe that people used to vote with their wallets and now they vote with their time. And that great brands simply win the battle for time. And so that's strategically linked to where we make our money. We help brands create communications that are authentic enough and relevant enough and interesting enough and timely enough and informative enough that the person consuming them goes, this was worth my time. It really helped me out or really entertained me or really inspired me. So that's what we fundamentally believe, that there's too much stuff around. Like, is it content? Is it advertising? Who did the brand pay for it? Like, look, people just want good stuff. They want good stuff that makes their lives better and saves them time and saves them money. They don't care who funds that.
Two more questions before we wrap up. First one is, you're a leader. You're around some of the top leaders in North America. What are three attributes or qualities that you found consistently in the top leaders today?
Typically named Dave. No, I'm kidding. That's a shout out on the gender inequality that still exists in the C-suite. Well, I think they're curious. I think they're always curious about seeing things through and like, well, what happened if we did that? And they're curious about different people's perspectives. And they're curious of, I think curiosity is someone who continues to seek and learn. And so I think that is really critical. Secondly, they are willing to admit when they don't know. They're very self-aware. Like they know what they're really good at. They know what they're not good at. They know where they have valued perspective and they know where they don't have valued perspective. Just because you're the CEO, that doesn't mean that you should know everything or that you should make every single decision. So the curious, kind of self-aware. And then the last one is, I think the people who are, there's an element of them that they're not satisfied, you know, like that they want to go, no, is this the right thing to do? Like they're challenging in a really respectful way, but they don't just want to be the nicest person in the room. That there's an element, sometimes those, you see those people and they're like, yeah, but they're letting stuff, you know, be done. And just because they want it, they think that the CEO should be the nicest person in the room. There's a There's always somebody, there's a layer of like they're difficult to please in some ways because they're so attentive to some of the details. And it's that third one that maybe I'm weakest in, that maybe it's, you know, that I'm maybe too, well, it's all up to you and whatever you think is great. And when my heart of hearts, I know that like, I'm not happy with something, but I don't speak up enough.
The final question, and if it's too personal, we can edit it and say, no, thank you. It really touched me though, when you shared a story at the Art of Leadership. When I saw you live, I was in the audience. I was sitting beside Martin Perlmutter, and you ended your keynote with a story about your father, I believe, and what it taught you, what you learned, and how it made you in some ways, at least part of your character today.
Yeah, that was I think the technical term is a ballsy move.
Okay.
Because here was 2,000 people, or 2,500, or however many people it was. And I ended an hour-long keynote with a story that I'd never told on stage before that was incredibly personal. So that's not something that you would typically do. You want it, that's your HBO show. You want it all to be tested and proved out. I think it worked. It was a good choice, but maybe not one I should have tested out first and worked out some of the kinks of it. But the short version of the story is that, you know, my dad was not in my life. Left when I was one and was never really in my life. I mean, I knew who my dad was, and he would occasionally pop up from time to time, but did not support the family. Was a horrible dad by every definition of it. And at the end of his life, like his cremated remains. Ended up in the storage unit of somebody that he didn't even know. And that person kind of reached out and said, I have your dad's remains here and I don't know what to do with them. And it was basically because that he just had alienated every single person in his life and hadn't kind of loved people. And I don't know, maybe allowed himself to be loved. But I think when we talk about legacy and leadership and so many different things, that it really is just that simple. Do we love people? And I don't mean love them in an intimate way. Do we care for people? Like, do we care for other human beings? And maybe that should be the first, you know, principle of leadership. That do we care for partners? Do we care for employees? Do we care for a client's problem? Do we actually care about it? I think if we do want legacy, that will be the thing that often defines it, is did we just care for people?
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Where can we find you online to learn more about what you're up to?
I'm in my basement. If you came to the side door, I'd let you in. You can find me at, you can just Google Ron Tight. There's not many of us. The aforementioned father was one, the senior. And so I used to get like creditor phone calls and people like, you haven't paid your bill. I was like, oh, you're looking for senior. So there aren't many Ron Tights in the world. So just Google me and you'll find various things or follow along on LinkedIn.
Ron, as always, it was an honor. It was a learning experience, and it was a lot of fun to spend some time with you. Thank you so much for making the time to be on the Leadership Standard with us today.
Thanks, Jamie. Thanks for having me. Always an honor to be in any conversation with you. It's always an enjoyable one. And to all of you who listened in, thank you. Yes.
Yeah. Love it. So we looked at the leadership journey of one of Canada's premier entrepreneurs and speakers, Ron Tight, from his time and his revelations as a camp counselor through university at Queen's, where he found himself in the business program surrounded by some of the top leaders in Canada, all the way to present, from employee or creative director to running and leading his own ad agency, Church and State. We learned about purpose-driven leadership from a real practitioner, how to resolve conflict with your partner, and some fun yet relevant terminology like pitch slaps on social media, or how to create content on a regular basis, or what the purpose pivot is. If you want to hear more from leaders like Ron Tight, don't forget to subscribe to The Leadership Standard on your favorite social media platform. I'm Jamie Mason Cohen, and I am the host of The Leadership Standard.